It's the 12th of April 2013 and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Does a Thatcher party pack come complete with a full set of treacherous cabinet ministers? Is Margaret Thatcher like a Walkman? Should doctors be able to tweet anonymously? What can we learn from the USS Thresher disaster? And can you 3D print a nuclear bomb? But before we begin, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, this week, we've contracted out the show to a number of different private providers who have sent us their segments without any regulation or oversight. Which is why this week we've got four pieces about Margaret Thatcher in competition with each other. So let's start out with a discussion about her legacy, which was connected to her torso-y. That doesn't really work, does it? This week we've heard a lot about how Thatcher is basically responsible for everything the Tories think is good in the world. But would a lot of these things have actually happened without her? Here's Dave Cole, figuring out whether or not the lady turning was actually relevant at all.
A friend of mine was jubilant at the death of Margaret Thatcher, proclaiming her to be responsible for nigh on every social ill in Britain today. Beyond that, they hated her. Not disliked, hated. My friend was born in 1988. Certainly old enough to be affected by the end of the Thatcher era, but hardly well politically aware. I can certainly understand the dislike of a particular person in the public sphere, but the passion for someone who had not been on the political scene during that person's, my friend's, political maturity was surprising. I can understand why someone who was in the NUM in the 80s might have such a passionate hatred of Margaret Thatcher, but someone who was only able to vote in 2006? If you follow the discussions about the death of Margaret Thatcher, you'd come to the conclusion that there are only two possible opinions to hold about her. She was either the ultimate guardian of freedom, liberty, and apple pie, or she spent her time in office literally beating kittens to death with other kittens. This might be couched in more diplomatic terms, defender of freedom, made Britain great again, hard on the Irish, hated the miners, but it essentially comes down to the same two options. Some sort of neo-Elizabethan avatar of greatness, or marching under the advancing banners of the Prince of Hell. These are, however much the advocates of the two sides might disagree, the same position. They are both saying that Thatcher defined an epoch, changing politics, economics, and society to be more to her liking. The only difference is whether the speaker finds Thatcher's morals and politics to their taste or not. Neither side disputes that Margaret Thatcher pushed monetarism onto Britain. They merely argue about whether it was good or bad. Neither side argues about whether Thatcher crushed the miners. They just put it in terms of necessity or vindictiveness. Neither side would deny that she was the ringmaster of the political circus. Was she? Was Thatcher's rise to power in Britain unique? Ronald Reagan, of course, came to power in the USA, but Germany had Helmut Kohl, or François Mitterrand had from the mid-1980s to cohabit with Jacques Chirac. Denmark saw the first conservative prime minister for 80 years in Poul Holmskov-Schlüter, while Brian Mulroney took power in Canada. To a greater or lesser degree, they all bought into ideas of small government, monetarism, privatization, and so on. So, what about the economy? It would be quite wrong to look back on the 1970s as a golden era from which we were untimely ripped. The economy certainly changed between Margaret Thatcher's accession to power and her tearful departure just over a decade later. The economy, regardless of who was in power, was going to change. The Bretton Woods system had collapsed in 1971. OPEC raised the price of oil in late 1973, precipitating an oil shock and indeed, perhaps, the stock market crash of 74, worsening a recession that would last until 1975. This was the era of stagflation and the end of the Wirtschaftswunder. Mr. Buttskill, if he ever lived, was by now well and truly buried. This was a time of change. industry did decline as a percentage of GDP while Margaret Thatcher was in power. However, it was doing so before she was in power, after she was in power, and indeed did so in every G7 and now G8 country from 1970 to date. There's a link in the show notes to a gap-minded chart with the data. And what about the Cold War? Was the Iron Lady of the Western world in her red star chiffon evening gown, her face softly made up and her fair hair gently waved, indispensable? Certainly, she played a role, giving strong political support to the US, not least through the replacement of Polaris with Trident. It is worth remembering, though, that in May 1981, not long before the Falklands War, the professional head of the Navy of the day, the First Sea Lord, Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Henry Leach, warned of the effect that the proposed defence cuts would have, not least because they fell, in his perception, heavily on the Navy. You could certainly make a case that any leader of a liberal democratic capitalist state, and particularly one of the UK's size, would have an important role in the end of communism. I do ask, though, how it compares to the impact of, say, Lech Walesa, who she supported, or John Paul II, or the maintenance of Ostpolitik by Helmut Kohl, before we even get to the many actions taken by the United States. And Thatcherism. We seem to have a need to condense philosophy, situation, and style into an ism, summing up someone's tenure in high office in a single word. I don't want to overdo it, but you can split Thatcher's time in office into a more managerialist early phase that became hardened, ideological, and perhaps doctrinaire later, even as it caused the resignation of lieutenants like Geoffrey Howe. I'm not trying to make an argument that people don't matter, or even that Margaret Thatcher didn't matter. The particular way she dealt with, for instance, the miners did, it seems fair to say, do a lot of damage from which former mining communities have yet to recover, although I do ask what effect Arthur Scargill's refusal to hold a ballot may. The trends we saw over the 80s didn't have to manifest themselves in the precise way they did, but looking around similar countries, it does seem that those changes were not limited in effect or impact or existence to the UK. I feel reasonably safe in assuming that most of the listeners of the Pod Delusion are liberal or left by political persuasion. It is perhaps worth remembering then that some things Margaret Thatcher did, by design or not, were progressive. The grocer's daughter would outrage what she'd probably have considered Hampstead liberals in her cuts to the arts and so on. But the rise of the grocer's daughter was also a decline, at least to some extent, of the Knights of the Shires. This was, despite her protestations to conservatism and wanting to bring back the morals of a bygone age, an attack on the establishment, both the liberal and the establishment forms of it. Again, this may have happened anyway, but it does, I think, at least bear consideration. It may be that the polarisation of opinion on Margaret Thatcher is a much bigger question of presentation. Regardless of whether given changes were necessary, she is presented, and particularly in the latter period of her time in office, as cold and unfeeling, or solidly determined, depending on point of view, and that she never felt the need to appeal beyond her base or justify her actions. Ronald Reagan may have carried out similar policies in the USA, but he did it with a genial smile and a honeyed voice. If we are going to have a debate about the legacy and impact of Margaret Thatcher, we need to put her in historical perspective. What we've had so far is little more than the received wisdom of different sides of the polity of the UK. If we really want to say that Thatcher's time in office was good or bad, impactful or not, or preferably some mixture of the above, it does seem that we need to be at least considering some counterfactuals, and we need to be looking at what was going on around the world at the time. Perhaps Clement Attlee was a great prime minister that transformed the country because he had the good fortune and good sense to be elected when the country was going to transform anyway. Maybe Margaret Thatcher just didn't matter that much. For the Pod Delusion, this is David Landon Cole.
So the Sun front page this week had a big story about how Margaret Thatcher had been voted the most popular Prime Minister since 1945. I know. Who'd have thought that in a poll conducted in the days following her death, the general public would vote her number one? Anyway, this is all part of the speculation we must do as producers of news content to try and contextualise Thatcher and place her in a historical narrative, which is why in this next piece, Miles Taylor argues that Margaret Thatcher was actually like a Walkman.
Did you cry or rejoice when the Walkman died? It was a world-changing device created in 1979 and later overthrown by a series of newcomers, each of which it had fundamentally influenced. Its existence continued to be dragged out beyond the point where it really had any relevance, until its surprisingly recent demise. Now, I didn't. I was indifferent. Early this week, an old lady died. Apparently upset and confused through many of her later years, and with little contact with her children. I can't bring myself to be happy about this. I dislike unnecessary suffering, wherever it is, and it seems that she had a pretty terrible time of it towards the end. Of course, clearly lots of other people also had a horrible time of it, because of her, during and since her reign as Prime Minister, and I understand the joy and the grief that people are pouring out. But she's just not that important, and hasn't been for years. Now, Maggie is a Walkman, and I don't think about Walkmans anymore. I'm concerned at the moment about whether to move all of my music from MP3s to streaming services. The fact that the tape was the medium that revolutionised music consumption and was the first usable and affordable portable device doesn't matter to me one bit when I can store all of my music on Google Play or other services and stream it live onto any device in the world. It's worth remembering and learning from history, but not at the expense of the present. I remember my first portable music device. It wasn't an official Walkman because we weren't that rich, and it chewed up my tapes about every fifth use. And even those that didn't get chewed up stretched over time, and as the batteries ran out, the music would slowly grind to a halt. These problems were unique to the tape era, much as the poll tax, the miners' strike, and children drinking milk were unique problems of Maggie's government. What Thatcher fundamentally changed was the fact that music could be personal and portable for the first time, and the Walkman opened up free markets in a new way, beginnings of a project to roll back the state, undermine collectivist movements, and monetize every aspect of life. Later came Blair, with his shininess, magnetism, and apparent indestructibility. I guess he's the CD in the story. The fundamental principles are very similar to the predecessors, and in many ways it's just a much better, pleasanter, and more reliable version of it. Brown is a minidisc, technically actually quite good, but everyone's already invested heavily in CDs and doesn't want to replace a whole lot. And sadly, MP3s came along before they can get really dug in. Both Brown and the minidiscs are victims of poor timing and circumstance. MP3s should really be the modern Conservative and Liberal Democrat parties. They almost sound, to the untrained ear, like music, but they lack depth, range and substance. We've got a new set of problems with MP3s, and these are largely different to those of tapes. So when the tape Walkman finally stopped getting produced in 2010, people were too busy worrying about digital rights management, or trying to make iTunes work, rather than mourning its passing. And this is exactly what we should be doing now. The coalition government is carrying on a lot of the ideological work of Thatcherism, but often in brand new ways. Worrying about the death of one lost old woman is distracting and no kind of victory. This is the month that many of the welfare and healthcare changes have come into force, and we absolutely must not forget that or allow this to be submerged in misguided and misspent wrath. We should turn our attention to the next stages of the development. Rather than singing about the wicked Walkman being dead, we need to work out how we can ensure that the cloud can be freer, fairer, and more equitable as a solution than personal possession of musical hardware ever has been. I really hope that streaming turns out to be some sort of progressive, liberal, socialist haven, but I'm scared we'll end up with something much more like the sinister blonde clown. This has been Miles Taylor reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, just in case you've just tuned in, I can confirm that yes, Margaret Thatcher is still dead. Though if you switch on the news channels, chances are there's something about her labelled breaking news. Now, there's been a lot of anger going on, both left and right, since she died. On the left, there's been criticism that the funeral will apparently cost £8 million. I'm assuming that's because they're getting DreamWorks in to animate many of the dinosaurs in attendance. And on the right, there's been anger at people who are happy about her death. But have that many people actually been celebrating? This week, Caroline Spurry has been wondering about whether people are actually using the so-called Thatcher Party packs.
Is it time to party? Margaret Thatcher's death has been anticipated for some time. Like many elderly ladies of frail health, no one thought that she would last forever, at least in her bodily form. However, unlike most elderly ladies, her obituary has been ready to go to print at a moment's notice in newspapers across the country, and, unusually, party packs have been made up to help people celebrate her death. These party packs, called Ding Dong Thatcher's Gone Party Packs, were in the news last September after they were on sale by traders at TUC conference in Brighton. T-shirts and mugs with anti-Thatcher slogans on were also available from traders at the conference. One design had a grave with the word Thatcher written on it, and the words, "A generation of trade unionists will dance on her grave." With Margaret Thatcher's promotion of the free market and encouragement of people to make their own money, maybe she would have been proud of an entrepreneur putting together a few themed party items and selling them at a profit. After all, that general idea of selling party stuff for a profit did those Middletons an awful lot of good. Baroness Thatcher herself has not, to my knowledge, made any public comment on the party pack or any other anti-Thatcher merchandise during her life. The Mail reported the sale of these items during September's conference as grotesque and obscene. Television and radio interviews discussed the party boxes at length. Despite the outcry and public disgust, by day two of the TUC conference, reports have claimed that the Ding Dong Thatcher's Gone party pack boxes had completely sold out. Such was their popularity. Why? Made by a company called Red Stuff, the packs have been around for a number of years. Priced at around £10, the Red Stuff website describes them as everything you need for your party. Specially themed balloons, party whistles, indoor firework, party poppers, and special invitation cards to give to your friends. All in a collectible cardboard box. They have been selling steadily for many months, but now that the event has finally happened and the Iron Lady has passed away, has the grim reality of her human death caused people to stop and think? Sales in anti-Thatcher merchandise have rocketed on the news of her death. Mugs, t-shirts, party packs are flying out of the shelves and into people's homes. But for what purpose? Are people using them? I find it difficult to imagine that people are actually using the invitations from their party pack to send out to their friends, inviting them to a jolly shindig to celebrate this wonderful news. Are people happily blowing up their balloons and pulling their party poppers, singing Ding Dong, Thatcher's Gone? Many people do feel that a huge amount of damage was done to our country while she was Prime Minister. Industries disintegrated, jobs vanished and lives were wrecked. People then despised her with a passion, and that vitriolic hatred remains. It is a reflection on the depth of this hatred that people still feel this way about her, in her passing. These people don't want us to forget what she did to them. They want to undermine this perceived propagandising of the Tory party to try to deify her. A lot of those party packs are being sold. They're heading up north to the places where she tore to pieces the disenfranchised, disempowered people who feel frustration mingled with that hatred have a small way to mark their deep anger, to metaphorically dance on her grave. Such bitterness, such hatred is what has led people to want to celebrate. It is perhaps a kind of thought to imagine that people are buying such items as a piece of quirkily distasteful memorabilia along the lines of a royal wedding sick bag, something which states your political belief but is not going to be used for its notional purpose. I don't suppose anyone, for example, has actually vomited in their royal wedding sick bag. I mean, not on purpose anyway. And maybe no one has sent out their Thatcher's Gone invitations to their friends and blown up their themed balloons. Maybe. People buy these items, seen by some as outrageous and grotesque, seen by others as quirky and satirical, just to be a part of history. This is Caroline Spurry, reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, one last Thatcher-related piece. Don't worry if you're a little bit over-Thatcherated by all of this. I guarantee that this will be the last thing you hear in the media about her for at least, well, at least the rest of the show. So now we've got Corey Hazlehurst, who amidst the news that Ding Dong the Witch is Dead will probably be near the top of the charts on Sunday, has been looking back at a slightly more cerebral musical critique of Thatcher.
I was born in 1987, a couple of months after Margaret Thatcher's third and final landslide election victory. So like many of my generation, my thoughts on Mrs. Thatcher were developed vicariously through my parents, and through my dad in particular. My first experience of politics as a baby would have been Dad blowing raspberries at her whenever she came on the television screen. Something else I inherited from my dad was a love of the music of Elvis Costello. And it's one of Elvis's songs that I want to talk about in this piece. For one of Costello's songs, Tramp the Dirt Down, could well be returning to the charts this week. At the moment, it's fifth in Amazon's top MP3 downloads this week, and is hovering in the iTunes top 100 as well. It's certainly been in the news after George Galloway tweeted Tramp the Dirt Down in reaction to Mrs. Thatcher's death on Monday. It's about more than Costello fantasising about dancing on Thatcher's grave, though, and the song's much more intelligent and compassionate than that caricature suggests. Tramp the Dirt Down was first released on Elvis Costello's album Spike, released in 1989. It's a sprawling, brilliant collection of songs, as Costello wrote in the liner notes to the reissue of the album 20 years later. I had the blueprint of five albums in my head, and I seem to have elected to make all five albums at once. The album became a bit of a hit, thanks to the success of Veronica, a song co-written with Paul McCartney, and has many brilliant tracks on it, including Satellite, a weirdly prophetic song about cable television. What with it being 1989, the album was released on LP and cassette, and Tramp the Dirt Down was the last track on side one. The song itself is by no means the only song Costello has written about Thatcher or politics. His biggest hit, Oliver's Army, is a wonderfully subversive pop song, with lyrics about sending working-class kids to fight and die in wars they don't understand over a piano riff adopted from ABBA's Dancing Queen. Tramp the Dirt Down isn't even Costello's best song written about Thatcher's Britain. For me, that honour goes to Shipbuilding, a lament about the Falklands War, which has an achingly beautiful trumpet solo from Chet Baker on it. But Tramp the Dirt Down is the most direct, and definitely the angriest. In it, Costello sings he'd like to live long enough to stand on your grave and tramp the dirt down. Although there is undoubted hatred in the song, the reason why you get shivers down your spine listening to it almost 25 years after it was first on the album is because the song itself does not sound angry. Costello recorded the song with a group of Irish folk musicians, which gives the song one of the most beautiful melodies on the album. He sings the song not with a sneer, but with a rather mournful, resigned air, which contrasts with the gruesome, macabre message of the song. And this, I think, gives the song an added poignancy. After all, Costello doesn't want Thatcher to die. He does sing that, "I hope you live long now, and I pray the Lord your soul to keep." And it's lines like these, as well as lamenting the plight of a schoolboy whose head's like a tin can, being filled with dreams and then poured down the drain, which make the song such a powerful attack on Thatcher's Britain. After contemplating the song again this week, the line I find most striking is when Costello sings that Thatcher takes all of the glory and none of the shame. This is something that we've seen over and over again in many of the sycophantic tributes from across the right of British politics this week. We've heard many very serious people say over and over again that Thatcher saved Britain and made its economy marginally more efficient, whilst ignoring or remaining seemingly ignorant of the massive social costs these changes brought. Much like the Iron Lady herself ignored them then, it's fair to say. Tramp the Dirt Down is still a great song. It's worth downloading and listening to, as is Spike, and the rest of Costello's back catalogue, if you haven't heard it. But that doesn't mean that we should be invoking it now to celebrate, for that's really what's happening, in many cases, I think, for celebrating the death of an 87-year-old woman. After all, Tramp the Dirt Down was written when Thatcher was still Prime Minister and seemingly invincible. In interviews given at the time of the album, Costello admits that writing the song was an unreasonable response to Thatcherism, and he felt terrible for thinking these thoughts. For an MP to invoke the song now is, surely, simply bad taste. As Costello sings in the song, you've only got the symptoms, and you haven't got the whole disease. Celebrate Thatcher leaving office, celebrate the end of Thatcherism in Britain, if it happens, but don't celebrate the death of a rather senile 87-year-old woman. That's just a matter of common decency, and if I had seen anyone holding street parties to celebrate my dad's death last year, I would have probably gone out and hit them with cricket bats. This was Corey Hazelhurst, who used to be disgusted, but is now trying to be amused, for the Pod Delusion.
Other news now, and one of the stories that has recently fallen under the radar, is the news that the General Medical Council have introduced new guidelines for doctors who want to use social media. Apparently doctors are no longer allowed to tweet under a pseudonym, which sounds a little bit draconian. Personally, I'd like to know if this affects me, as I've been offering people medical advice via Twitter for years, even though I'm not actually a qualified doctor. Anyway, to explain more, here's Peter English.
The General Medical Council, or GMC, is the regulatory body for doctors in the UK. Actually, almost anybody can call themselves doctor, although, thankfully, Gillian Keith may not do so, at least in her advertising. But for the purposes of the rest of this podcast, I shall use doctor to mean registered medical practitioner. That's the protected term. Good medical practice is the doctor's law book, setting out what doctors must and must not do. It's called guidance, but it isn't really. As it says in the introductory sections, serious or persistent failure to follow this guidance will put your registration at risk. In other words, not following the guidance could get you struck off, disgraced and unable to earn a living in the profession you've trained for. Even being investigated by the GMC is stigmatizing. As soon as an investigation is started, your name is put on the GMC's list of doctors under investigation, which is in the public domain, freely available at the GMC's website. In April last year, the GMC launched a consultation about what should go in the next version of Good Medical Practice. I expect that many doctors yawned, had a brief look at the Julia's Day soap opera comic strips, which we used to discuss ethical issues, and decided that they had many more pressing things to do. Most of us, after all, have to read and digest a welter of mail, email, journal articles and guidance every day. If we don't prioritise ruthlessly, it's going home time before we can get around to doing any actual work. Trying to raise awareness of and mitigate the impact of the Health and Social Care Act seemed more important at the time, and the GMC draft guidance didn't look all that controversial after all. It was interesting that there was a section on doctors and social media, but it seemed sensible. It reminded us about patient confidentiality, which we're very used to, and that if you adopt a pseudonym or contribute anonymously, you can't guarantee that your identity won't at some point be revealed. Actually, it only refers to anonymity, but mostly that means using a pseudonym. Oh, and there was a bit about, if you were writing in a professional capacity, you should usually identify yourself. It went on to explain that any material written by authors who represent themselves as doctors are likely to be taken on trust and or to represent the views of the profession more widely. I didn't notice that at the time, but it didn't seem to involve any instructions, so it could be safely ignored, even though, in retrospect, it seems rather dubious. Why, if I'm posting on, say, libel reform or the latest Pod Delusion, does the GMC that anybody should think my views are those of all doctors? Odd, but harmless. But then, last month, the GMC released the latest version of Good Medical Practice, the laws by which all doctors must abide on pain of not being doctors anymore. The revised version created a bit of a stir in the Twitter sphere. The British Humanist Association and the Secular Medical Forum were concerned, as you'd expect, about the section and the explanatory guidance on personal beliefs. They were concerned that doctors' freedom to opt out of doing things their religion was opposed to, such as a Roman Catholic doctor not being involved in abortions, might also mean, for example, that women needing emergency contraception might have this delayed, reducing the chances of it working. And they were concerned about a section saying that doctors should consider a child's parents' religious views, specifically mentioning male circumcision. Reading the BHA and SMF statements, you might think the doctors were obliged to do things if the parents demanded them on religious grounds, regardless of the child's best interests. But actually the guidance puts the best interests, as assessed by the doctor, of the child first. I'm sure the Pod Delusion will return to the subject of circumcision in the future. I might even contribute some thoughts myself. But the GMC's guidance doesn't force doctors into doing it where they weren't before. No, the thing that caused most of the Twitter stir was the section on, well, Twitter. The perfectly reasonable wording of the original consultation draft had been replaced with something that can only be described as illiberal and misconceived. The revised and supposedly final wording of the guidance starts, "If you identify yourself as a doctor in publicly accessible social media, you should also identify yourself by name." The guidance also says that doctors should follow your organisation's policy on social media. Isn't it remarkable that the GMC has read all our organisation's policies, including those not yet published, and knows that they're all perfectly reasonable? But let's return to the part about doctors having to identify themselves by name. This will be a licence for lawyers to print money. They'll make money quibbling about what exactly included in the term publicly accessible social media, and they'll make money quibbling about what the word should means. It's not as strong as must, but does it or does it not give doctors discretion to ignore the guidance? But the main thing is that the guidance will not allow doctors to post anonymously or under a pseudonym, not unless they are able to keep their profession a closely guarded secret. And why should they have to do that? Now, I've never used a pseudonym. My name is Peter English, and my GMC number, if you're listening, GMC, is 3002861. But lots of doctors do use a pseudonym. Some of the most interesting, and indeed the politest doctors I follow on Twitter, do so under a pseudonym. People have questioned why doctors should want or need to use a pseudonym, but that's the wrong question. Why should they have to justify it? And why should the GMC want to ban them from doing so? Even the GMC are right that, quotes, "any material written by authors who represent themselves as doctors are likely to be taken on trust and or to represent the views of the profession more widely." How much does banning doctors from posting anonymously help? After all, the GMC can only restrict doctors from practising. It can't do anything about charlatans who pretend to be doctors but aren't. And while making doctors accountable if they make stupid medical claims might make some sense, how can it be proportionate to extend this to everything they post or tweet? And that's not taking into consideration that if, like prolific tweeter Welsh Gas Doc, you're also called Dave Jones, making him one of about 40 doctors with that name, whereas if you have an uncommon name you could easily be identified, which seems odd and unfair. As long as doctors are acting within the law, there can be no justification from banning them from posting anonymously. They should be able to do so just because they prefer to, and the guidance doesn't seem to consider that doctors might actually have a sensible reason for doing so. What, for example, about reflection on practice or asking about clinical problems? This has to be done with scrupulous care to avoid identifying the patient you're discussing, of course. One of the ways to enhance the patient's confidentiality is to make the posts anonymously. There might only be one patient with a clinical description in that particular doctor's practice, but there might be hundreds of them across the country. Keeping the doctor's identity private will help conserve the patient's anonymity. And what about doctors who are concerned about identity theft, or who'd prefer to keep their privacy and tweet about their personal or social lives without all their patients being able to follow them? More seriously, what about doctors who have patients with a grudge against them, perhaps for refusing to prescribe addictive drugs or to give unnecessary sick notes? Or doctors who engage with hostile groups like the anti-vaccine activists who are responsible for the measles outbreaks in Swansea and elsewhere? Shouldn't they be able to tweet or post anonymously? Why should doctors put themselves at risk? Perhaps, more importantly, we've just seen the Francis report on the mid-Staffordshire hospitals. There's a history of sidelining or scapegoating whistleblowers in the health sector, so why make it worse by stopping doctors from whistleblowing anonymously, or at least from seeking support and advice about how to blow the whistle without risking their own career? Indeed, the guidance will put doctors who post or tweet in jeopardy, even if the GMC never gets involved. Whistleblowers and other doctors that employers find difficult can be blackmailed by employers with the mere threat of a GMC referral. The GMC often takes years to reach a judgment, and during this time your name is on their website as under investigation. If an employer finds out that a doctor has been posting or tweeting anonymously or using a pseudonym, then they can use this as a lever to, say, silence a potential whistleblower. As a professional regulator, GMC guidance must be compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. Several GMC rulings have been overruled by the courts recently. And if the GMC ever finds a case against a doctor on the basis of this guidance, I'm sure it will be appealed in the courts, and that the GMC will again be humiliated. The guidance is chilling in terms of both free speech, Article 10 of the European Convention, and the right to a private life, Article 8. Both of these are qualified rights. The state, or the regulator, is permitted to infringe them, but, as the government guidance says, quote, "when taking decisions that may affect any of the qualified rights, a public authority must interfere with the right as little as possible, only going as far as is necessary to achieve the desired aim." So I'd like to ask the GMC to answer three questions. The first is, what is the desired aim? What is the nature and the scale of the problem that the changes are intended to address? Are they trying to stop doctors from promoting dodgy products by using their status as doctor to sell ineffective treatments? Or do they think that by banning anonymous posts by doctors, this will somehow stop abuse or bullying on the internet? Second question is, what is the evidence that these changes to the guidance will do what they intend? As doctors, we believe in evidence-based practice and evidence-based policy. What is the evidence that the harms that the GMC claim these damages prevent actually exist, and that these changes to the guidance will reduce them? And what is the evidence that the guidance won't have unintended adverse consequences, so they do more harm than good? Many great medical bloggers have announced that they intend to stop blogging rather than lose their anonymity. Do the GMC really want this to happen? And if so, why? And finally, is the GMC really convinced that the guidance is consistent with UK law and the European Convention on Human Rights? What legal advice did they receive on this? I've concluded that the GMC simply didn't understand or think through the implications of the guidance. I don't want the GMC to be humiliated, but the minor humiliation of reverting to the original wording of the consultation document, now that doctors have seen what they've turned it into, would be negligible compared to the humiliation of being forced to do so by the courts. This is Peter English, GMC number 3002861, signing off for the Pod Delusion.
Now, could you use a 3D printer to make a gun? Or what about a nuclear bomb? Since thinking about this last week, I've been rocking back and forth, hidden in the corner, fearing for the future of humanity. But should we panic about the future? Or should we be tooling up in preparation? Here's Sean to explain more.
There's been a lot of coverage recently about printable weapons. So James asked me to take a look at the whole area of printable and home-built weapons and what new threats they offer. First, though, what do we mean by printable weapons? 3D printers are already here and make objects by either extruding material in the manner of an icing nozzle, precipitating material from a liquid reservoir using light beams, or fusing material together from layers of metal powder using a laser. The liquid and sintered metal printers tend to be very expensive and are mostly used for industrial and medical prototyping. The extruding printers, however, are rapidly becoming cheaper. For under £1,000, you can buy a printer that can produce small plastic objects up to about 10 centimetres long. The raw material is relatively cheap and is usually supplied in the form of a filament, like a very thick fishing line. Since the printer can produce almost any shape on demand, as long as it can be described as a series of layers, it would be trivial to create a plastic dagger. It wouldn't be terribly strong or sharp, but it could easily be sharpened further after printing, and for a single use would be entirely adequate. Getting the designs also easy. Since it's solid with no moving parts, a 3D scanner of the surface of an existing knife will work as a template. Stabbing someone's a bit personal though, which may explain why guns are so popular. Could you print a gun? Probably not all in one piece. The barrel is the most difficult part of the gun to get right. It needs to withstand the enormous forces as the propellant charge explodes and guide the bullet without jamming, otherwise the whole thing will explode. Most printable guns take the barrel as given, but then print the receiver, the framework which houses the rest of the device. Using standard screws and bolts for any metal parts required makes the construction of a complete gun quite simple and almost untraceable. Unconstrained by existing designs, it's conceivable that new gun designs can be built to resemble everyday objects. The cell phone gun has already been used in several crimes and is confirmed as real by Snopes.com. The ability to print one of these at home, rather than having to go to a black market gunsmith, is a bit frightening. How small could you make a gun like this, though? It will be limited by the availability of ammunition, which can't yet be printed at home. The smallest calibre commonly available is 0.22 inches in diameter, about 5 millimetres, which sets both the diameter of the barrel and the amount of propellant charge. The barrel must be thick enough to withstand the explosion, and it needs also to be long enough that the expanding gases can push the bullet up to the required speed to do damage. With a very simple trigger, we're looking at something a few centimetres long and a centimetre or so in diameter, about the size of a highlighter pen or a magic marker. It would be easy to conceal, and could be made into almost any shape. Its one weakness is the barrel, though. It must be straight, strong, and solid. If you're trying to take one on an aircraft, it will be the single most recognisable component on an X-ray. And if you're not trying to conceal it, why not just buy a proper gun? They're relatively easy to obtain if you really want one, and they're less likely to blow up in your hand than some homemade one-shot special. Okay, what else can you cook up at home? Chemical weapons don't become significantly easier with 3D printing, except that again you can probably make a custom case for the delivery or mixing mechanisms. It's becoming more and more difficult to obtain truly hazardous chemicals, and that's the rate-limiting step here, not the printing. Biological weapons run into exactly the same problem. Getting hold of dangerous organisms in the first place is a bit difficult. You can't just pop down to Boots and pick up a vial of Ebola. Well, maybe in the homeopathy aisle, but that's not going to be much use. What about the ultimate weapon? Could you create a mini nuke at home? The problem with nuclear weapons is they're inherently non-scalable. You need to gather together a critical mass of fissile material, otherwise the neutrons that are produced are more likely to escape than to continue the chain reaction. So not only do you have to get some plutonium, you have to get quite a lot of it, about 15 kilos. Even if you go for something more exotic, like californium, you still need 5 kilograms or more. You can reduce this by reflecting neutrons back into the fuel, but neutron reflector materials are inefficient, so you need a big thick layer, which again, is not conducive to miniaturisation. In the 1990s, there was a flap about a fuzzily described miracle material called red mercury, which would, in some unspecified way, reduce the critical mass of a nuclear explosive. Some said it was a neutron reflector, some said it was a powerful explosive which could compress the fuel more effectively. The best explanation so far is that it was a hoax designed to sell various unspecified goo to would-be rogue nuclear powers, which seems like a risky prospect to me. So, anyway, I won't be cooking up any miniature nukes in my shed this weekend. But there is one final miniature weapon, where a speck of explosive the size of a grain of salt packs the same punch as a ton or more of TNT, and the fuel can be made from nothing more than electricity. It's called antimatter, and luckily for us, you need a large particle collider to make it, and some seriously impressive technology to trap it, slow it down, and keep it contained once it's been made. Total usable world production to date has been a few hundred atoms. So I don't think we're going to be using that as feedstock in our printers. So, for now, custom-made gun cases seems to be the limit of homemade weapon design, which, given the possibilities, is something of a relief. As to how we actually regulate weapon designs, well, that's an entire different podcast segment. This is Sean Ellis, printing out an origami AK-47 on his normal printer for the Pod Delusion.
Now, last Wednesday was the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the USS Thresher, the biggest ever submarine disaster. This week, Drew Ray has been looking back at the intriguing story and finding out what we can learn.
Oh, the Thresher, the finest atomic ship that ever dived for the sea. Each man on board was a volunteer, was there 'cause he chose there to be. Every man Jack on board was a hero. Every man Jack on board there was brave. Every man Jack on board was a hero. Each man risked a watery grave.
April 10 marks the 50th anniversary of the loss of the USS Thresher, a nuclear attack submarine operated by the United States. The Thresher sank during sea trials, with 129 men on board, making it the worst ever submarine disaster. We will never know exactly what happened during the last minutes of the USS Thresher. The only sources of information we have are trial data from before the accident, communication between Thresher and its companion rescue vessel, sonar records, and experiments conducted afterwards. We don't have any direct physical evidence of the equipment failure. It's generally believed that what happened was there is an electrical failure causing shutdown of the nuclear reactor powering the boat. Unlike land-based nuclear reactors, there's no truly fail-safe state for a submarine reactor. Shutting down the reactor protects against a runaway nuclear reaction, but it also takes away the main propulsion system. This is a problem because nuclear submarines typically rely on propulsion to reach the surface in an emergency. At the same time as the reactor was out of service, the USS Thresher also had negative buoyancy. The boat was sinking, and the only way to drive it to the surface, the nuclear-powered propulsion system, had been shut down by the automatic safety systems. This is where we enter the realm of guesswork. The most widely accepted theory, and the one that was adopted officially, is that there was a single cause of both of these problems. A leaking pipe caused flooding, making the boat sink, at the same time as the water shorted the electrical system, making it impossible to drive the submarine to safety. Whatever the cause, the submarine sank below the depth it was designed to withstand and was crushed by water pressure. It took less than 10 minutes from the initial problem to the destruction of the submarine. Death would have been instantaneous for everyone on board when the submarine imploded. 50 years later, there are lessons from the Thresher disaster which are still highly relevant. Why did the investigators believe that a pipe leak caused the shutdown? Simple, because the pipework was known to be unreliable. During USS Thresher's most recent overhaul, a new technique called ultrasound was used to inspect the silver brazing used to join the pipes. Using this technique, it was found that a large number of joints were faulty. Rather than accept this evidence that the brazing was unreliable, ultrasonic testing was discontinued. This is the sort of decision that was echoed by NASA when they discontinued quantitative safety analysis because the numbers were unacceptably pessimistic, and by the oil rig Deepwater Horizon when failed cement tests were disregarded as false alarms. It seems obvious, but apparently it does need to be said often and loudly. Don't bother conducting tests unless you're willing to listen to the results. Safety engineering is very similar to science. You don't investigate to confirm what you already know to be true. You test to try to disprove your current theory. You're willing to listen to an answer which says no. You don't have to be a safety engineer or an experimental physicist to understand this. You just need to know how to read a project's schedule. Look at the amount of time allocated for safety analysis and testing, then look to see what's next on the schedule. There should be a large chunk of time allocated to fixing the problems that you're going to find. Too many project plans assume that testing will find no problems, totally defeating the purpose of the testing. USS Thresher is not the first disaster or the last disaster to be reconstructed from test evidence. There are pieces of the Mars Polar Lander scattered all over the surface of Mars. We know why this happened, because after the accident, they completed the testing that they should have done before launch. There's no physical evidence of the O-ring failure that destroyed Space Shuttle Challenger. Just MIMOs beforehand complaining that they hadn't been tested at low launch temperatures, and recriminations afterward. When I'm describing accidents, which necessarily involve stories of human fallibility, I always like to highlight the people who did something right. The ground crew who ran towards the burning Hindenburg. The engineers who scuba dived in pitch black radiated water under Chernobyl. The firefighters who entered the North Tower of the World Trade Center after the South Tower had already collapsed. Unfortunately, we don't know the stories of those who tried during those 10 minutes to save the USS Thresher. We do know what we need to do to stop a USS Thresher happening again. There's a longer version of this report, with references, on my Disastercast podcast. I'll put a link in the show notes on poddelusion.co.uk. This is Drew Ray, reporting from Canberra for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, we end with our last couple of interviews recorded at the Royal Holloway University Science Festival a few weeks ago. To explain more, here's Liz Luckendorf.
And now, the thrilling conclusion to our Royal Holloway Science Festival coverage. This week we've mixed it up a bit with our final two interviewees, with plant ecology and stem cells, and some theoretical computer science. First up, we have Professor Enrique López-Uez, who investigates how plants detect light. So one of the things that I looked up on your profile is that you study like photosynthesis and things like that. How complicated is photosynthesis? On Wonders of Life, which many people may have seen, Brian Cox mentioned that it's so complicated that it only evolved once. Is that true?
That is true. That has to be qualified. all right. So photosynthesis is about reproducing what people believe was the ancestral source of energy for all living things, a sort of differential of concentration of protons on two sides of a membrane, reproducing it using light to generate that difference in the first place. Now, that, as far as I know, has happened at least twice. That was invented twice by bacteria in two slightly different ways, but within bacteria, some who were already using one acquired the other, and they became bacteria able to use both what we call photosystems in tandem, one after the other. And doing that allowed to generate an electrical current, which is what generates this difference in protons, generate that electrical current, taking the electrons to begin with from water. And when water has the electrons robbed, the byproduct, the leftover, is oxygen. And that is called oxygen-generating photosynthesis or oxygenic photosynthesis. So oxygenic photosynthesis evolved only once from those two pre-existing forms of photosynthesis. Now, that happened in bacteria. Some of those bacteria became parts of other organisms, other cells, and came to live inside them and became not fully free living organisms, but what we call organelles, parts of larger cells. And when they live outside, we call them bacteria, oxygenic photosynthetic bacteria. When they live inside and have a semi-independent life, but mostly dependent, we call them chloroplasts. And chloroplasts became parts of cells in algae, and some of those algae became plants, and some of those plants became trees and our crops, and et cetera, et cetera. So that oxygenic photosynthesis has then been passed down the line to everything we see in green around us.
You look at how light is used as a signal for stem cells and plants to make new leaves. Are these the same kind of stem cells, I guess, but not exactly, obviously, that we find, you know, with like in skin cells that regenerate all the time and things like that? Are the same kind of cells, I guess, as the stem cells we have in us?
In many respects, they are. A difference between how plants develop and how we develop is that we developed inside our mum's womb. So when we were born, we were essentially a little person. Plants don't develop like that. Plants develop a little plant when they are embryos. They are carried inside a box that we call a seed. They go dormant. The seed can be dispersed about. And when the seed finds itself in good conditions, the embryo wakes up and forms a little plant. Now, that little plant may look very different from the wheat plant or the tree or the bush that it will become. And that is because development carries on. Plants cannot respond to the environment by moving around. What they can do is develop in different ways. And so the development of a plant, contrary to ours, is continuous. In ours, it's a little bit continuous. You know, we replace our hair all the time, but largely we are set when we are born. Plants are not. And so plants do have a little bit of embryonic cells throughout their life at the tip of every branch, at the tip of every root. Scientists call these groups of cells meristems. But they are essentially groups of embryonic cells. Those are the stem cells that we talk about. And if we want to understand how photosynthesis happens, in ways which are good in nature but not optimum for us or for our crops, and we want to see how we could modify. We want to first understand how you make a leaf, or how do you make a chloroplast. And the approach we are taking is, well, how do plants switch on the making of leaves or switch on the making of chloroplast? And it turns out that light is a key clue they use. If there is light, they will switch on leaves, and those leaves will make chloroplast. If they're in the dark, they will not switch on leaves. Or if they produce already an embryonic leaf, we call a cotyledon in a seed, that will not make green chloroplast. So what happens when the plant first sees the light? What happens to those embryonic stem cells to become leaves? What happens to these little undifferentiated cousins of chloroplasts to become chloroplasts? That's what we are trying to understand in order to see how could we make this better suited for our crops.
Next up is Professor Dan Cohen, who is a theoretical computer scientist interested in algorithms.
So I guess the first place to start would be, what does a theoretical computer scientist do?
It's true that we all see computers everywhere in the world, and we have computers on our desks, but almost all the computers we see, we don't see. Computers run large companies, computers run accounts, computers solve problems for us, computers run cars, computers fly planes. Computers don't do more things than they used to do because computers have got faster and smaller. Really, they do more things than they used to because we're much, much better at programming them. We've got new programming languages, we've got new architecture, we've got new constructs, but most importantly, we have new algorithms. So the way in which you write a sequence of instructions to tell a computer what to do, we have been inventing over the last 30 years new algorithms, new techniques, more efficient algorithms, algorithms to solve new problems, and that's what's taken the world by storm. Theoretical computer science is the study of the mathematical, the underpinning of what makes algorithms good. How do I design algorithms? How do I tell if they're good?
So you're a theoretical computer scientist. What are we going to have in 10 years that we don't have now?
I like to predict what we'll have. I never predicted mobile phones. I failed to predict tablets. I failed to predict the massive increase in speed in internet communication. I did predict data storage, which was already growing, and computer power. I've got no idea what will happen. I can tell you something, though, something which is very odd, that when you, in 10 years' time, will think we always had it. If you ask people about the internet now, or mobile phones, they can't remember a time when their mobile phone couldn't direct them along the streets. And so the rate of change of technology and the way it's affecting our lives every day, and we're consumers of technology in a way we never were before. We just expect it every year to improve our lives.
You can find all our coverage and long edits of all these interviews at poddelusion.co.uk, as well as links to the Royal Holloway Science Festival. It was amazing fun working with the festival organisers, as well as the Science Festival being brilliant. So watch out next year for the Royal Holloway Science Festival. This has been Liz Luxendorf for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back to over 3.5 years of archives, as well as like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, if you're into those sorts of things. Also on our website, do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really do appreciate all the support the show gets, as it helps us pay the server bills and keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Dave Cole, Sean Ellis, Drew Ray, Peter English, Miles Taylor, Caroline Spurry, Liz Luckendorf, Corey Hazelhurst, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
She's dead then.
I know, I can't believe she's gone.
Always been there, ever since I was a child. Lover or hater, you couldn't ignore her. She should have been called Marmite, not Margaret.
Very good, very good. So, what side of the fence were you on then?
Oh, no, you're not going to draw me on that one. Now is not the time. Times like these, it's a definite line between person and politic.
Yeah, but some would argue that if we're going to spend the next week talking about what a fine woman she was, that should be balanced by the critics of what she did while she was in power.
What? But Brian, somewhere there is a grieving family, and that grief should be allowed to run its natural course before the vultures swoop in.
That's fair enough, but left unchecked, she'll be raised to the level of saint by her advocates.
She's made some unpopular choices, it's true, but she was at least a woman of conviction.
Yeah, she should have got a conviction after snatching all the milk from the mouths of those young children.
I have no idea what you're blathering about, but I know for a fact you've been stealing 2 pints of semi-skimmed off my step every Saturday for the past 10 years.
Yes, but my behaviour is a direct product of her opportunistic I'm all right, Jack, and sod the rest governance.
Well, I always thought she ran things fairly and was a big advocate of community.
Eh? During her time as Prime Minister, she did more to destroy the idea of community than anyone.
Prime Minister, what on earth are you talking about?
Well, who are you talking about?
Margaret Jones, you know, the chair of the local WI. Lives down the street. Well, lived. She got hit by the 147 route master just outside Greg's 2 days ago.
Oh, I thought we were talking about Margaret Thatcher, the ex-Prime Minister who died on Monday.
Thatcher? Why would I mourn that cantankerous old witch?